welcome listeners to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperone. We're really glad that you joined us and took some of your time to educate yourself about health, wellness, and issues in alternative medicine today. You can always get more information about our happenings, myself and the natural nurse, who has the day off, at naturalnurse.com. And Dr. Z naturally, and I hear my guest, Dr. Jennifer Jacobs. She is a physician and has her master's in public health, and she's a clinical professor in epidemiology at UW, School of Public Health, University of Washington. And she actually wrote a great book, which is the topic of today, The Dangers of Overmedication. And her book is Do You Really Need That Pill? How to Avoid Side Effects, Interactions, and Other Dangers of Overmedication. Just came out. I'm really interested in this because, you know, I've done lots of webinars and seminars on this particular topic, both looking at drug side effects, drug-herb interaction, and also drug-nutrient depletion. So we're going to be launching and talking about those types of things. And it's great that she's an integrative physician, and it's great to have more and more doctors realize that they are over-medicating folks and not checking with other specialists as to what drugs. It seems like everyone wants to put everyone on drugs and not check to see what the other physicians on the team is doing. It's one of the big faux pas that I see. But anyway, without further ado, let's bring Dr. Jacobs on the show. Welcome.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning. So I guess it's early for you, but let's talk a little bit about your book.
Yeah, it's early.
Sorry to get you up there, but I'm excited to have you on there. So let's talk about this. I want you to do a lot of the talking because, you know, I have a kind of a axe to grind with medicine over this, but I'd rather you talk about it from you being that you're a formerly trained allopathic physician and then sort of had this realization that folks were being over-medicated. Why did you have that revelation?
Well, you know, I've been concerned about people taking too many medicines ever since the beginning of my medical career. Even when I was in residency in family medicine, I saw that oftentimes the side effects that people were having of the drugs were worse than the symptoms of the problem they were being treated for. But more recently, it came to my attention when my mother-in-law ended up in the hospital with kidney failure, and she had been taking 13 different drugs, all of which interacted together, had side effects, caused her body to be depleted of fluids, and, you know, she ended up in the hospital. And I really hadn't been aware, doing integrative medicine, I didn't prescribe many drugs myself, and so I didn't really understand or realize how many drugs people were taking. And I started asking around and looking in the literature, and I found that almost half of people over age 65 were taking five or more prescription drugs daily. And this really shocked me.
Now, has there ever been, like, any studies on people on 13 different drugs? Did they ever do a double-blind, placebo-controlled clinical trial on putting people on 13 drugs and seeing what would happen to them? Because that seems to be what's happening. You know what I'm saying?
It's like they... I'm sure the drug companies would pay for a study like that.
They may not if they knew the side effects, that's for sure. The results of it might be disastrous, and that seems to be what's happening to people.
No, I mean, one of the problems with the whole system is that, as you mentioned, double-blind placebo-controlled trials are usually looking at just one drug versus placebo, and oftentimes the people that they recruit for these studies are people who aren't taking anything else. And so the results they get are not indicative of what the problems would be with that medication if someone was taking one or two or three or five other drugs. It's a very inefficient way to evaluate drugs.
Yes, and in a real live scenario, like you said, seniors and even younger people now are going to be taking so many of these medications at the same time, which have side effects upon side effects. Now, one of the things is the actual, that Dr. Kamai, the natural nurse, the co-host of the program, myself found out, is that many of the side effects of the drugs actually occur from nutrient depletion of many nutrients. And there's some really great websites like Natural Standards and Natural Products and MyTavin, M-Y-T-A-V-I-N. That's a good website, folks, out there. If you want to put your medications in to the MyTavin database and then look to see which nutrients. I'll give you an example. I had a patient that just came in with Lyme disease just on simple doxycycline. You think, oh, okay, no problem. Maybe it interferes with your gut flora or something like that. I was horrified at all of the nutrients that doxycycline interfered with, and this is not made up. This is all hyperlinked with stuff right from the PubMed, National Library of Medicine. So how do drugs cause these effects, doctor?
Well, you know, it's the various drugs have various reasons, but one good example that I ran across in researching my book is proton pump inhibitors, PPIs, that many people take, you know, almost like candy every day for heartburn, GERD, acid reflux. Well, first of all, the FDA originally approved PPIs only to be used for 2 weeks. And yet people take them day after day, week after week, month after month for years. Mm. The other thing about these proton pump inhibitors is they stop the stomach from producing acid. Well, acid is necessary for absorbing many nutrients. So, for example, vitamin B12, calcium, iron, all of those need acid in the stomach to be absorbed. So people taking those drugs obviously are going to have trouble with having these nutrients in their body.
Yeah, and then they stay off them for a long time, and that, of course, then affects the physiology in a myriad ways, and you end up with a lot of the signs of nutrient deficiencies. And that then mirrors a particular disease. How do we get the idea that people are making too much acid? And actually, when I teach in the naturopathic school, I'm a professor there, I show studies that show that actually people are making too much weak acid. And if they could just make a little bit of strong acid, they would get the job done with their particular stomach. So that's why integrative physicians, naturopathic physicians, and herbalists and the like treat with bitters or maybe enzymes or things to actually bring the pH down a little bit in the stomach, not block the pH. It's just, I don't know where the disconnect in physiology is.
Well, it's all based upon the principles of allopathy, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and that is that you take a drug that blocks what the body's natural tendency is to do to respond to an illness. Just like, you know, when someone has a cold, they take an antihistamine, which blocks the production of histamine, which is important in fighting off a cold. So these are things that conventional medicine is not aware of, doesn't even look at. You won't find research, at least in most of the conventional medical journals in this area. But the other thing I wanted to say about acid reflux is that it's often not even acid reflux. it's usually often a weakness in the lower esophageal sphincter that is allowing stomach contents and acids to come back up into the esophagus. So that simple things like having small meals, sitting upright for a while, not going to bed within a few hours of eating a meal can help a lot with this, even without having to take herbs or supplements or anything else.
Right. And I guess doctors aren't reimbursed for discussing lifestyle modifications and alternatives to medications. That might be one reason why we got ourselves in this conundrum.
That is an excellent point. Yes, yes. Doctors don't get paid for counseling people about wellness, and instead they will just prescribe pills. I just saw, though, that they're talking about having a, what would you say? They're talking about paying doctors all the same fee for every office visit, no matter how complicated it is. And I'm hoping that that might help doctors have more time to talk to patients rather than fill out paperwork.
Yeah, I mean, we should be paid almost like attorneys in a way, be on retainer and talk about health and wellness, and not just based on disease, but based on health. It's just a different way.
Absolutely.
Or concierge medicine. You know, where we're kind of just paid a retainer, and it's our job. It's like the ancient Chinese doctors. If they let their patients get sick, well, if you were one of the royal doctors, you'd have your head chopped off. We don't want to go that far, but you would actually lose your paycheck if you let your patients get sick.
Yeah, that's very interesting, isn't it? I've heard about that. But yes, there's just not enough emphasis. I mean, for example, cardiovascular disease. Most of the doctors will just prescribe a drug, likely a statin drug, which, of course, has all sorts of bad side effects. But instead, I read in one study that 80% of cardiovascular disease can be prevented by healthy diet, exercise, and not smoking. And yet, we don't hear about that. We don't see ads on TV. Can you imagine ads on TV for a healthy lifestyle?
Yeah, yeah. I just put Lipitor in the database and found out that it depletes the body of zinc. And there was an article in the Journal of Trace Element Research in 2005, the effect of statin therapy on serum trace element status in dyslipidemic patients, and they looked at simvastatin and other statins and found out that, you know, it really lowered lots of minerals, and that could be a big problem, particularly zinc, copper, selenium, even glutathione and CRP went down. So that's scary because, you know, CRP is a measure of inflammation, and, you know, you went to medical school just like all the other doctors. Don't they learn that cholesterol is only one of a whole chain of events that has to happen in order for atherosclerosis to become entrenched, that there has to be damage to the intimal artery through hypertension or through homocysteine levels or through not enough antioxidants, oxidative stress, that's the first lesions that have to happen in order for the atherosclerosis to come about, and that cholesterol is actually, you know, part of the whole repair process. I don't know where did the research go askew that then Lipitor and a lot of these statins became like candy.
Well, you know, it all has to do with money and the pharmaceutical industry, and they're the ones who fund 80% of research. And so you're not going to get research on these questions that you're bringing up. I mean, cholesterol is a very important building block in the body for hormones, for neurotransmitters in the brain. I mean, 25% of cholesterol in the body is found in the brain. So we need cholesterol. And as you mentioned, some people theorize that cholesterol being high is actually a protective mechanism. You know, it's a fat, it's oily, and that it actually goes up when people have inflammation and damage to their arteries, and the cholesterol goes in there and tries to protect the arteries. So focusing on cholesterol is really single-minded. And as you say, there's lots of other factors, family history, high blood pressure, obesity, diet, all of these things affect heart disease, and yet the medical profession is just focused on this cholesterol number, which is really a poor surrogate for health.
Yeah, plus a lot of folks are, you know, as they get older, their hormones go down, and cholesterol is the building block, the backbone of male and female hormones, as well as all the adrenal hormones. And there's a tremendous amount of... Yeah, go ahead. Follow
and
up on
vitamin
that.
Vitamin D, which is very important for all sorts of functions.
Yeah, and also pregnenolone, which pregnenolone is the grandmother of all the steroid hormones, and pregnenolone itself has been shown to be incredibly important for memory and brain function. And, you know, when people are on statins, that whole mechanism kind of gets shut off. And
and the rise in dementia that we're seeing, studies have shown, in fact, there's a warning from the FDA on statin drugs that they can cause problems with memory and cognition. And there have been several studies published that show that people who have had signs of early dementia or even more severe dementia, stopping their statin drugs, and it reverses.
Now, you said something that I found interesting. You said that the pharmaceutical companies are involved in this whole reason for why people are on so many medications. Is that true, or is that just like a conspiracy theory?
Do they really spend
a lot of money and time with Congress to lobby them?
Yes. Yes. The pharmaceutical industry, first of all, spends $14 million a day, each day, for advertising directly to consumers. That's number one. And the United States is the only country in the world, besides New Zealand, that allows direct-to-consumer advertising. These are the ads that people see on TV when they're watching the news. In fact, one study estimated that the average person who watches TV, who's not me, but sees 16 hours of drug ads over the course of a year, much more time than they spend with their doctor. The second thing, like you mentioned, is lobbying Congress. $150 million a year they spend on lobbying Congress and other government agencies. And the third thing, which I just recently found out, is the pharmaceutical companies pay users' fees to the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, which amounts to $0.5 billion each year. So the FDA is reliant on the pharmaceutical companies for a good part of their funding. And therefore, when they're asked to approve drugs, they speed up the process to keep the pharmaceutical companies happy, oftentimes to the detriment of people because they don't look closely enough at possible side effects.
Now, why doesn't most of the young medical physicians kind of realize this? Is it because of the way they're trained and it kind of changes the way that they think about medication? Or, you know, you went to medical school. Did you find that you were resisting some of this, or would the professors put down someone that wanted to do lifestyle and diet as a major intervention? What was your experience?
Yes, my, well, you know, medical school is really an indoctrination program. And the amount of time that's spent on, for example, nutrition is less than 20 hours out of the whole medical school curriculum for a large majority of medical schools, even though the American Heart Association is now recommending that doctors be trained in lifestyle, diet, nutrition, and so forth. But no, the money, medical schools also get a lot of money from pharmaceutical industry, research studies that are done by medical school professors are often funded by drug companies. So they really have their fingers in every pot. And no, I got very little about nutrition, wellness, lifestyle, maybe nothing when I was in medical school, which was more years ago than you can probably imagine.
How did you make the switch? Interestingly enough, how did you make that switch then?
Well, actually, I became dissatisfied and disillusioned early because I saw that throwing drugs at people were what most doctors did. And I felt like I was being trained to become a glorified pill pusher. So, you know, I looked in other directions and started thinking about trying to make people healthier or help people become healthier rather than just give drugs that suppress their symptoms without really curing their problem. If they stop taking the drugs, the problem is still there. So I felt like conventional medicine really wasn't getting to the root of things with people.
I see. So then you started to train and see nutrition and go to conferences and kind of hang out with other integrative physicians, I would assume.
Yes, yes. And I found that there was indeed a community of doctors, small, but very dedicated, that didn't want to treat patients superficially with drugs that would only cover up their symptoms without helping people to become more healthy.
So what's the number one? So we talked about digestive problems and we talked about statins. What's the other major classifications of drugs that or illnesses that people are put on with medications? And is there ever a time that medication is the proper way? You know, we're trained in naturopathic school that, yes, there is something called the therapeutic order. And when somebody has let themselves go so far down the road of illness from wellness that sometimes heroic measures, drugs and surgery, are extremely important to kind of stabilize them enough so that Mother Nature can work, albeit slowly sometimes, to restore the health of that patient, if possible sometimes. That's kind of our, well, we're trained, and I train my students because I teach naturopathic philosophy and history at the University of Bridgeport. But I'm curious from your perspective what your opinion is or philosophy.
Antibiotics, for example, are indicated in a very small percentage of cases when they're given. But, for example, someone with meningitis or pneumonia, I would probably prescribe antibiotics. Someone who has diabetes type 1, of course, needs to take insulin. Mm-hmm. But in my practice, very rarely did I have to treat people with prescription drugs. Most of the time, just giving treatments that stimulates their body's own healing would be enough. And as you say, sometimes it's slow, but it's more long-lasting.
Yeah. What about if someone comes in with, multiple issues like Lyme disease or something like that. So they were bit by the tick. Now, we know from the literature whether we, some doctors are not trained in this, but, you know, in Chinese medicine or other types of medicine, there are many herbs that kill microbes. That's for sure. All you have to do is look at Mother Nature and look at how trees and penicillin itself came from a mold, a mold toxin. So there are many examples of that. But they might say, well, you know, the person has Lyme disease. The only standard of care is to use doxycycline or something else like that. But there are a lot of ways to stimulate the body's immune system so that you can fight the fight. You mentioned fight the fight. So is that like a philosophical difference? Because drugs usually do the job of, for the body versus nature.
Well, it's not black and white, but in most cases, I think properly treated, that people can fight off most illness without taking drugs. But like I said, there are cases where people do need to take drugs when things have taken a dramatic turn, like you said, and the illness has progressed beyond where the vital force can overcome it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. What are some of the, a lot of the patients that come see you, are they on the 13 drugs or whatever that, and then what's the proper way for weaning people off of these things? This gets tricky because, you know, it gets to do with, you know, stepping on other doctors' toes that prescribe the medicine, maybe working together to get the patients healthier. Maybe you need to do some investigation in unraveling the true reason why they have the disease. What's been your
advice to people? I don't really advise people to stop taking their drugs without their doctor's knowledge or consent, their allopathic doctors. What I recommend is that people make a list of all the drugs they're taking and then research them, like you said, on the internet, the website that you mentioned, as well as there's another website on drugs.com. Okay. Where people can enter the list of all the drugs they're taking, and then they will get they'll get information back about side effects of what they're taking, as well as interactions. Because my mother-in-law, when she was taking 13 drugs, we had no idea how they were all interacting. But by putting the names of all of her drugs into this website, we were able to see which ones were likely interacting with each other. And then, so once people have done that, then they need to go to their doctors and say, look, I don't want to take all these medicines. What can I stop taking? And of course, having a naturopath or an integrative physician on the team is also important. But I don't advise people to do this without checking with their physician.
Yeah, which, you know, begs the question that if, you know, if you're only trained in drug management, are you really the right person to be asking that question? So, but we're going to take a break now because it's half hour. We'll pick that very controversial question up. I'm in that conundrum too, you know. You know, you want to work with the hypertension and have the patient practice meditation, look for atherosclerosis, look for vascular impediments, check the kidneys out, do a good differential diagnosis. I mean, doctors are supposed to use the acronym VINDICATE to look at all possibilities for why the person has that pathology. VINDICATE, we'll talk about that when we return, teaches the doctor to think of all the possible possibilities, not just prescribe something based on the symptoms and forget about it. Hypertension is the worst example of that. I've rarely seen a good workup of why the patient has hypertension from many allopathic physicians, sometimes naturopaths too. just basically you treat the symptom of the high blood pressure and then you forget about the whole thing. You don't keep digging. Well, why is this? Well, why is that? Dr. Bastier always taught us to ask, well, why is that? Anyway, well, we have to take a break and play our natural medicine chest, and we'll be back with more of this exciting program with Dr. Jacobs, who wrote this great book. Stay with us, folks.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the ancient Chinese science and art of acupuncture.
Acupuncture is a 5,000-year-old medical procedure involving insertion and manipulation of needles into specific points on the body. It is often applied to relieve pain during surgery and for many other conditions.
Acupuncture needles have been found in China that are over 4,000 years old. The first needles were made of stone. Later, bronze, gold, or silver was used, and today they are usually made from steel. Acupuncture was developed around the theory of special meridian points on the body connected to the internal organs, and that vital energy, or qi, flows along these meridians. According to this theory, diseases are caused by interrupted energy flow, and the stimulation of these points restores normal energy circulation. There is some scientific evidence of the existence of the meridians as a separate circulatory system. Studies were done in the 1970s by a Dr. Kim from Korea, where he injected radioactive dyes into the traditional acupuncture points. He observed migration of the dyes along the exact predicted path of the meridians.
Okay. How acupuncture works remains uncertain, but both Western and Eastern scientific studies on rabbits have shown that the analgesic effects are not simply a matter of suggestion. After the discovery in 1975 of endorphins, natural pain inhibitors in the body, some neurophysiologists suggested that the needles may trigger the release of these substances. American and Chinese studies have confirmed that placing acupuncture needles in the brains of dogs raises the level of endorphins in the spinal fluid.
Acupuncture is used today in most hospitals in China and by many private practitioners in virtually every country in the world, including the United States. The primary use is for analgesia, although ulcers, hypertension, asthma, and other conditions have been documented to respond favorably to this treatment. Chinese surgeons prefer acupuncture to the use of drug-induced analgesia because they claim it does not disturb normal body physiology and therefore does not make the patient vulnerable to shock. Brain surgery is especially amenable to this form of analgesia when it is necessary to keep the patient awake during the operation.
Although some modifications in the practice of acupuncture have been made, such as sometimes using a small electric current on the needle instead of the traditional twirling, acupuncture remains intact as an ancient therapeutic technique that has been used successfully for at least 5,000 years. Perhaps you'd like to add this piece of knowledge to your natural medicine chest.
And I guess we're back. I guess we're back with more of the program, and thank you so much for joining us. And we're in the midst of a fabulous discussion and, you know, full of controversy, too, that's for sure, which I like. I love discussing this, the dangers of over-medication with Dr. Jennifer Jacobs, and she has her doctorate, of course, as a medical doctor and family practice physician. And also, she does integrative medicine, and she went to school at UW, which is kind of, it's funny, I spent a lot of time studying at UW Library, going to Bastier, being a Bastier University graduate, so I know UW real well. They have a great medicinal plant garden, too, by the way. I was just thinking about that a few days ago. But anyway, and she's the author of Do You Really Need That Pill? How to Avoid Side Effects, Interactions, and Other Dangers of Over-Medication. So welcome back, Dr. Jacobs.
Thank you, Dr. Z.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So when did you go to Bastyr?
I graduated in 1990, a long time ago. Yeah. So when the campus was still on Latona Avenue.
Right, I remember.
Yeah, even
that.
before the new campus, and I remember jogging around the new campus and thinking that would be a great place for a school, and talking to Dr. Pizzorno about that, and he's like, "Oh yeah, I know about that place, but unfortunately, the lease—it's still leased." And so anyway, it ended up becoming that the school eventually moved to a beautiful campus there. But
yes, it is beautiful.
Yeah. I need to get out there again one of these days, do some lecturing. But so anyway, I mentioned that, you know, here patients are in a conundrum. It's like, you know, they hear our great show, they read your book, they want to make a move, they need the guidance and blessings of their doctor, but the doctor is kind of putting their heels in because, A, they may not be with it as far as looking at drug-herb interactions and polypharmacy and drug nutrient depletions, or maybe they just don't like the fact that their doctor-patient relationship, maybe they just feel like they're not on even footing with their patient. There could be a myriad of explanations why doctors, maybe they think that the patient's being foolish and they would be litigated against if something happened. There's a myriad reasons for why the scenario that we talked about before break maybe wouldn't happen, and then the patient is left, you know, still on the medications. And this happens all the time with me.
Yes.
You know?
Well, one other factor that you didn't mention mm-hmm. is the time thing with doctors. They are given only a certain amount of time to see each patient. And it takes time to talk about getting people off of drugs, to talk about alternative methods. And as far as herbs and nutrients and so forth, that, you know, doctors just aren't familiar with that. But some of them are open. I think that a lot of doctors think that patients expect to get drugs when they go to see them. And the patients will feel disappointed if they go see their doctor and don't come home with a prescription. So if they find someone who's questioning all of this, they may be willing to work with them if it's brought to their attention, you know, in a non-challenging way. And also I counsel people to bring this up at the beginning of their doctor visit, not at the end when the doctor's going to rush out of the room to see the next patient.
Good point. Very good point. Yeah. So now, in your book, you talk about some major issues that come up when people are on medication. And, you know, I'm actually going to be lecturing at the Restorative Medicine Conference in Burlington, which is at the last weekend of September. And the topic is, you know, alternative approaches to pain. And, you know, I'd probably say that maybe next to digestive complaints, pain seems to be what most patients experience. And I have statistics, of course, in my lecture where musculoskeletal pain is like probably one of the major reasons why people go see their physician. Many of us have experienced, you know, musculoskeletal pain. Injury, you know, I'm a black belt, and so sometimes get beat up in matches and class. So I'm always looking for, that's actually one reason what drew me into natural medicine is I would have been one of those people that would have, like, burnt out their kidneys and liver on ibuprofen and other drugs, stronger drugs, if I didn't find anything natural to help. And so that was one of the big factors that led me to natural medicine. Same thing with Dr. Kamai. She hurt her back falling off a horse when she was a teenager, and she explored natural medicine like acupuncture, like we talked about in our little five-minute mini program there. And so do you see lots of patients with arthritis and osteoarthritis or arthritis and pain? and on pain drugs, even opioids?
Well, you know, opioids are very prevalent in our society, but thankfully that this has become part of our national attention and doctors are cutting down on prescribing opioids. But yes, chronic pain is something that a lot of patients complain of, especially older patients, 65 and older, hip pain, knee pain, back pain. These are things that happen after years and years of living. But there are a lot of natural alternatives that people can use rather than pain medication. Physical therapy, physical activity. They've found that exercising both aerobically as well as strength and stretching exercises can help quite a bit with pain. You probably know more about this than I do, seeing as how this has been a problem for you. But things like Tai Chi, yoga, massage, chiropractic, acupuncture, homeopathy, arnica is something very good, as you've right. probably taken for your aches and pains. Mm-hmm. And then also an anti-inflammatory diet and certain herbs like ginger, curcuma, omega-3 oils. All of these things can help with chronic pain.
Well said. Excellent. Covered most of the big ones, that's for sure. Yeah, I've had the opportunity to actually help wean people off of opioids using some very interesting plant medicines that have been around since, antiquity. One of the things I remember in school at Bastyr learning about is Jamaican dogwood. And so I learned that the eclectic doctors, who were medical doctors like yourself at the turn of the last century, but they didn't want to use a lot of chemicals because the allopathic doctors at that time, very similar to even today, it's interesting how history repeats itself, were using, lots of pretty toxic things. Back then, of course, they used, arsenic and mercury and calomel and some of those things. And so the eclectics sort of were medical doctors who I think were more educated in particularly plant medicines, and they wrote lots and lots of great books on them. Many of the great herbal books that I use in training the naturopathic doctors of today are from those old eclectic doctors. And so the Jamaican dogwood was one of those plants that they said you would use Jamaican dogwood when opioids would be recommended but could not be tolerated or something like that, so to speak. And sure enough, my research led me to the jungles of Jamaica to study actually with a Jamaican bush doctor who was trained and knowledgeable in the maroon medicine. And I found that he was saying the same thing that the eclectic doctors were saying, that Jamaican dogwood, whether it was topically put on as a poultice or internally, was very important. And that's one way I was able to manage to get people off of opioids. But
that's very interesting. I wonder if they've done any studies.
Not a lot. That's the whole problem, is that they haven't. There's not too many modern studies on it, just basically the writings of the eclectics and a lot of clinical knowledge, which, I think people put down clinical knowledge as anecdotal or whatever, but I think clinical knowledge is very important in understanding how things work. Medicine.
Well, if it helps someone, that's the bottom line.
Yeah. One of these days there will be a big study on that, I'm sure. But, that's one of
Well, you have to find someone to fund it, because studies are expensive. And
yes.
Unfortunately, unless there's a profit to be made, it's very difficult to get funding.
Exactly. And that's kind of what many practitioners of natural medicine have kind of run into, Now
go ahead.
No, go ahead. You finish your thought.
I was going to say, speaking of opioids, one of the interesting facts that I came across, a research study that showed that actually NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, were just as effective, if not more effective, in treating chronic pain than opioids. They enrolled patients in this study for a year, and they followed them, and they found that such outcomes as pain as well as ability to function was just as good, if not better, in patients who were taking the NSAIDs than those who were taking opioids. And so I think this is something people don't know. Although NSAIDs themselves are not safe, because there are something like 16,000 deaths every year from people taking over-the-counter anti-inflammatory drugs. So they are dangerous in themselves, but they're certainly superior to taking opioids.
Boy, if an herb killed 16,000 people, you'd hear about it.
Exactly. Yes. 40% of acute liver failure cases in the United States are due to overdoses of Tylenol.
Yes. It's given, people don't realize that, you know, Tylenol becomes this very powerful quinone-like molecule, and that it's very damaging to the liver and other parts of the body. Now, it's interesting that, you know, I remember one doctor said if aspirin and Tylenol were developed now, they probably would be, you know, prescriptions only, but people use them with reckless abandon.
Yes, yes. It's important not to take too much of them, for sure.
You mentioned losing weight could be very helpful for arthritis, and you had some interesting studies in your book which showed that, you know, when you lose weight, you put a lot less pressure on your cartilage over time. That's a good thing as Americans are getting heavier by the minute.
Yes, that was a fascinating study. Let's see if I can find it here. I don't remember all the exact numbers, but there was a study that showed that losing just 10 pounds would take so much pressure off the knees. When you're walking a mile, it would be a lot better. But losing weight isn't easy, yeah. But you know, people can do it. But weight management is also important for controlling diabetes, type 2, high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, you know, the obesity epidemic that we're experiencing right now is really detrimental to many, many people's health.
Now, so many people are also depressed. I know you talk about that in your book extensively, you know, for many reasons. You know, it could be, you know, situational, could be other things going on with their nutrition, maybe even their neurotransmitters or whatever. But nonetheless, a lot of the depression is treated with pharmaceuticals. Now, that could be okay if someone's suicidal and need to be stabilized, again, the therapeutic order that we talked about. But I think that they're also prescribed with a little recklessly, some of these drugs, particularly even in young kids, you know?
Absolutely. Yes, antidepressants are way overprescribed. In fact, in adolescents and young adults, they've actually been associated with suicide and suicidal thoughts as a side effect of antidepressants. But in my research for the book, I found that maybe one out of seven people who take antidepressants are helped by them. And of course, as you say, people with major depression, yes, they can be helped, but the vast majority of people with depression have mild to moderate depression. And exercise, for example, cognitive behavioral therapy, both of those things have been shown to be equally, if not more, effective than drug therapy for depression and more long-lasting. So again, it's easier for doctors and it's easier for patients to take a pill than to lose weight, than to start eating well, than to exercise. And it doesn't take that much exercise, really. 30 minutes three times a week is enough I mean, obviously it's better if people do more, but that's enough to help stave off many of these common chronic illnesses.
We were meant to move and meant to eat well and not meant to be sedentary and be out in nature, and here we are kind of living not really lives in harmony with that, those principles. And so medications are kind of the quick fix, but, you know, I think diabetes is a huge issue that you talk about in your book that could certainly be helped with proper diet and lifestyle and also nutrients. Like I found that, you know, I would say 98% of the diabetics that I've treated a long time are very deficient in chromium and vanadium. And with the proper prescription of chromium and vanadium and proper diet, we're able to wean people off of the diabetic drugs. You know, it takes time, but it took time. I always tell patients, give me a month for every year you've been sick. And they always laugh. Oh, boy, that's a lot of months. But I say, well, you didn't get like this overnight. It's not going to, but you will see changes.
Yeah, but people are looking for the miracle instant cure. So it's difficult for them to think that way. You mentioned sedentary lifestyle.
Mm.
One study that I found showed that more than 23 hours per week of being sedentary, and this was done in middle-aged men who they recorded how much time they spent in front of the television, more than 23 hours per week increased the risk of heart disease by more than 60%. And just getting up and walking around for 2 minutes every hour in someone who has a sedentary job, sitting in front of a computer or whatever, getting up and walking around for 2 minutes every hour is enough to take away the effects of being sedentary.
Yeah. I've done this whole radio show standing up and talking to you.
Good for
you.
Instead
of sitting in my desk, because I realized that, you know, yeah, you know, I'm supposed to be a hunter-gatherer, not, I mean, being a doctor, sometimes you can sit on your fanny too much. So sometimes I go out with walks with patients, and we consult there. And I think we need to rethink medicine. I get we're running out of time for the program, but I think we need to do a rethink of medicine. The old sitting in front of the doctor and prescribing pills and things like that doesn't seem to be a model that's, you know, it's doomed to fail at some point. I think the pharmaceutical companies are really at the heart of it, like you pointed out in your book. But can you leave our patients with some optimism for the future, maybe, of medicine and where we need to go?
Well, yes. I'm hoping that my book will start the conversation that really needs to be made about over-medication, and that people will start to think about having a healthy diet, walking, getting other exercise, stopping smoking, all of these very simple lifestyle measures that can really affect their overall health, instead of relying just, oh, that's a problem. I think I'll take this pill for this and this pill for that. And deteriorating health is something that none of us want to see.
And where can people get your book, Dr. Jacobs?
Well, it's available on Amazon. They can go to my website, www.jenniferjacobsmd.com. There's a link there where they can get the book.
Great.
And ask your local bookstore. If they don't have it, they can order it.
Great. Thank you so much for discussing a really great topic. Do you really need that pill, Dr. Jennifer Jacobs? I love that. How to avoid side effects, interactions, and other dangers of over-medication. We've only scratched the surface, but we've run out of time. But thanks so much for joining us here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, and keep up the great work. And that does it for another edition of... Thank you very much, yeah. That does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We want you to stay healthy, folks. Bye-bye.